The following is a presentation of Morning Drive Media and the Wrestling Viewpoint Network.
Welcome back to the Wrestling Viewpoint Network. I'm Ken Napsuck, along with Dan Farron, for another edition of the California Classic Wrestling Podcast. But this is our first in a never-ending, ongoing, never-to-be-closed series where we'll take a look at the Grand Olympic Auditorium and all its history, all its memories, and its legacy, and what it meant to Southern California wrestling. Dare I say, Dan, it is the Mecca of Southern California wrestling.
Oh, yeah. I mean, here's the thing. Well, yeah, it's the Mecca for Southern California. It's that version. Every place you go to. That was the nice thing about the old days was that, you know, if you were in Northern California, it was the Cow Palace. If it's New York, it's the Garden. In Boston, it's the Garden. It just depends on where you were. And each of the places took on a personality of their own. And quite often, the personality was very violent because wrestling fans used to, in those days, there were fans who really got into it and believed that a lot of the stuff that was going on was real, and riots would break out. And the Olympic was no stranger to riots. I mean, you hear, I got a whole bunch of old Olympic Auditorium newsletters I got from the 70s and the late 60s even. And you would see results, and people would say, this happened, Ernie Ladd pinned John Tolles, then a riot broke out. Like, it was just like this part of the whole, you know.
Just a thing that happened.
Just a thing. And
just part of it.
That's back. I mean, it's hard now for fans. You know, when you see a fan climb in the ring nowadays, you know, it's because they want to be on TV.
Yeah.
You know, but there were times that fans climbed in the ring to do bodily damage to somebody or to save them. I mean, I always love that story about when they were doing the blinding thing with Junkyard Dog down in New Orleans, which in part was taken from the Fred Blassie John Tolles. I mean, they saw how well that blinding angle worked, so they did it there. But they were the dog was supposedly blind and wasn't going to be able to see his little baby who had just been born, and the evil Freebirds were getting ready to jump him, and according to history, a guy jumped out of the audience with a gun and said, "Don't worry, dog, I got your back." You know, and that's not unusual. You would see that happen at the Olympic Auditorium and even some of the smaller auditoriums. People would get, and there's a great video on YouTube, I think it's from Detroit, where you can actually see a riot break out. I think it was Oxbaker, Ernie Ladd, someone like that. They were in the ring, and you can just get the feeling from looking at the audience. You can feel the riot building. And I've been to some lucha shows the same way.
Before we get too deep into this, I also want to introduce our guest here back again into the Wrestling Viewpoint Lounge studios. I call it Lounge Studios. Ryan Doyle, thanks again for coming back.
Oh, thank you for having me again. I appreciate
it. I'm so glad we didn't scare you away talking about the California Classic Battle Royal.
Oh, I love being here. It's so fun.
Thanks for coming back. All right, so Dan, where do we start here with the Olympic? Where do the memories begin?
Well, they begin back in the early 1920s when they decided to build a place for the Olympics. And it was supposed to be basically set up for boxing. That was the whole idea of the design. And if you've ever been inside the Olympic, you know, it's interesting because when you get in that upper tier, as Ryan can assess, it goes almost straight up. It's almost like climbing a ladder. It's not like a really ease like that. It's just going straight up that
almost
way.
Vertical.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, and many people have gotten nervous and got stuck up there. but I mean, the Olympic Auditorium, the Olympic itself, you know, the audience would. I mean, there's stories about fans pulling up armrests off of chairs and throwing them at people, and I think my favorite one, and I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but I would like to believe it because nobody was hurt in this, but that someone actually pulled up a chair and set it on fire and threw it off the top deck. And I wouldn't be surprised at that.
Well, I can tell you, and this is the God honest truth, that we were about 20 feet from a gentleman who pulled out a gun and shot it at the ring.
Oh, yeah. Now, you need to. We actually referenced that story on the first episode.
Yeah,
you need to tell us that story.
Did. Yeah. Through that.
We were watching, I can't remember what match was happening, but I just remember the next section next to where we sat every single week, and this guy stood up And all of a sudden, you just heard loud pops and this yellow brightness coming almost like out of his hand, you know, and shot it. I don't know how he missed, or I'm hoping he missed everybody. I'm assuming.
Wow.
But by the time he got about the fourth shot, he was pounced on by security. There was a security guy there.
Which is amazing that security actually pounced on a guy with a gun. That's just interesting. Who was in the ring at that time?
I can't remember now who it was. I want to say it was like...
who soiled their trunks in the ring at that moment? That's,
I was going to say, I want to say it was like Gordman or Goliath or something.
That would make sense.
Like that, you know? But this guy just... I just remember the loud pops and the bright... fiery coming out of this black gun.
Well, what was the reaction of the people around you? Did anybody move?
Everybody, you know, it was
did
like
the match
parting.
Stop?
It was like, yeah, the match stopped, and it was like everybody just around the area, just all of a sudden you saw this swarm of heads go downwards, you know?
Wow.
It was just frightening.
Oh, wow.
And I remember my brother kind of almost sort of like going over us and covering us, and we were just, it was a scary thing, but it was stopped rather quickly. Surprisingly and happily,
and the matches went on.
I think the matches went on about a minute after that.
I'd be back in the dressing room packing my bag at that point. I'm like, I'm going. That's
asking for a higher payout.
Was
that night.
Was that the famous one that you may refer to as the Frosty the Snowman slide?
No, you know what? That was a different fun,
a different riot. Yeah,
that was my oldest brother, who is no longer with us. He was a big guy. He was about 6'1" and about 320 pounds or so, and he kind of had this Joe Cool mentality a lot of times, you know, especially with his little brothers hanging around. And we had just gotten to the Olympic; the matches hadn't started yet. And the way the Olympic was shaped at the time, you had these platforms, I guess, the metal platforms that kind of angled down to the ring. And my brother was in front of us, and all of a sudden, whatever, he took a header and started sliding down the platform. And then all of a sudden, he got up and started like strutting all the rest of the way.
I meant to do that.
And I meant to do that, exactly. And, and meanwhile, my brothers and I are just dying. We're just laughing. And we're like, oh, look at Joe Cool being Frosty the Snowman over here. And he never lived that one down. But that was a classic memory for us.
Well, the Olympic itself goes, like I said, when they put the thing together, they put it together for the Olympics. When they broke ground, it was the boxing champion Jack Dempsey was the man who did the first shovelful of dirt. In fact, spoonful.
It took a lot of digging.
It's going to be a long time to build that. You know.
That's funny.
But Dempsey, exactly. But Dempsey's mural was up front there for many years because of that, and I've done a lot of research about the building of it, going back deep into the bowels of the Los Angeles downtown library, and paying it.
Wait, did you do that today for this,
I've done this over a course of a lifetime. Well, you have to realize again, nothing ever happens right away. And I think I mentioned before that I originally at one point, for the last 10 years, and I know Ryan because I've talked to him about it, have wanted to do something with this. Mm-hmm. So I started going back to the library back in the 1990s and researching, which is nice because I imagine a lot of the stuff they may or may not have there anymore.
Right. Know? And for the kids listening, the library is this building they have where you can go collect and rent books.
It's not an app.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there was a lot of press in 1994, 20 years ago, when they decided to refurbish and reopen the Olympic Auditorium. Uh-huh. And this is going to be mostly for boxing. And this is going to be the big moment. And what they did was, a lot of people looked at it that when they, the person who did the design on the Olympic Auditorium was a very talented architect named Gilbert Stanley Underwood, who also contributed to the designs of the famous Garden of Allah Hotel that used to be on Sunset Boulevard, the Federal Courthouse, and the post office annex nearby. And actually was an architect for the National Park Hotels in Yosemite. And he was just fresh out of school. He graduated from Harvard, and he was commissioned to design the Olympic Auditorium, and he did a beautiful job. I mean, it's an old school looking building. Now, of course, when they went and did the refurbishing to it, they basically wiped out any of the old stuff. And there used to be the marquee was the famous thing that I always loved, mm-hmm. the great classic marquee there. And I remember speaking to the Needlemans, who were the parking lot magnates who owned. Mm-hmm. And at one point, there was a lot of talk about them tearing the Olympic down and just turning it into parking lot space. Mm-hmm. And I remember actually your brother one time saying to me that he wanted to buy the Olympic Auditorium, and I said, "You're out of your mind. They're not going to sell you the Olympic Auditorium."
Well, it sounds like something he would say.
Exactly.
He had such a passion for that place.
But because it was, again, as we talked about, the old school buildings, it was a church.
Right.
It was a church to us. If you were a wrestling fan, going in there was like going to church.
Gotcha.
And I asked the Needlemans one time about the marquee out front. I said, "Are you going to put the marquee back up?" Now, whether this is apocryphal or whether this is true, but according to the Needleman, they were working on it. They went away for the weekend. When they came back, it was gone. Mm-hmm. Somebody had pulled up and loaded it up in the back of their truck and drove away with it, which I could believe in that neighborhood that they could get away with very easily. It was not, and the whole idea, even back in the 1920s, the whole idea was to revitalize the neighborhood. They felt that by building the Olympic, they would bring in people from outside and you could revitalize the neighborhood. So right. That gives you an idea that that neighborhood was already in trouble in 1920. Because it was true. I think a lot of people who didn't go to the Olympic didn't go because of the neighborhood.
Of the neighborhood.
You know, it was rather funky at that time. But when you went inside of there, and I was lucky enough to go into the Olympic when I was working on the Secrets of Pro Wrestling Exposed. We did
How dare you, sir.
I'm sorry. we exposed a lot of things. The business wrapped up and closed right after that. Stunt grannies be damned. But one of the things that they were in the process of rebuilding it at that point, and the dressing rooms were absolutely amazing to me, because you want to talk about the black hole of Calcutta. This place, those dressing rooms were little. Some people said they were literally 6x6. I mean, 6 feet by 6 feet.
Oh,
that's
wow.
all. And there were several of them in there. And I will tell you a really marquee thing I did.
Yeah.
They were all in disarray, whatever. And I reached in and pulled a chunk of the concrete out. I took it home with me. So I have a piece of the Olympic dressing room.
I'm going to tell.
Actually, don't worry, because I figure later this probably has all kinds of asbestos over, and I probably poison myself and will die a horrible, horrible slow death at one point. But those dressing rooms were really, really small. But when you walk again,
6x6, man.
Yeah.
Andre couldn't fit in that.
No, I imagine he had his own little 6x6 or whatever, but right. I imagine Andre spent most of his time at the bar.
Yeah, true.
But the thing about it is that it did the way it was laid out, it had this gigantic floor, and it had to have the ring, the size of the ring. That's the biggest ring in wrestling, was the Olympic Auditorium ring.
How big? 20 by 20. 20 by 20? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the way that it was laid out, so really no matter where you sat, you had a good view of the ring. And that's true. Even if you were up in the very top nosebleed seats, you always had a really good view of the ring. But there was something, when you walked around, all the murals of all the boxers around there, and you know, you talk about ghosts living in a building, the ghosts of the people, especially on the boxing side, where unfortunately there were several people who died or died on the offshoot. And there are some very sad moments in the history of the Olympic Auditorium where I forgot the exact gentleman's name, but he was a boxer who later died. And as they were wheeling him out on the stretcher, fans threw stuff at him.
Oh.
You know, and there's a real big level of hell and bad karma for stuff like that. But I think Olympic harkens back to the time when they designed buildings particularly for for certain activities.
Right.
And I believe it was bicycling and something else originally.
I think it was bicycling.
Yeah, that they set the Olympic up for. They also had to make a lot of room for TV. Now, did you ever go to any of the TV tapings there?
Yeah.
Yeah, where do they have that actual area, the famous blue wall that had the big NWA logo on it and the easel with the cards?
I believe that was right next to the big giant sliding doors at the back of the arena.
Yeah,
it was
that's where they were, right next to it.
You know, and you know, interesting talking about the Olympic. Dan, did you ever go to the roller derby?
Yeah, I did go to the roller derby.
I was surprised at how actually rather small the roller derby rink was compared to how it looked on TV.
Yeah, exactly.
TV, it looked ginormous, but when you got there, it was big, but it wasn't.
They have. I mean, I also went to a roller derby. They had one at the Forum one time.
Oh yeah.
And it was It seemed to me to be a much bigger rink. I don't know if it's because the layout. It appears to be bigger or smaller, whatever the deal is. And that's a question for Danny Wolf, who is our roller derby expert here. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that the floor had so much space on it. There, I could see where you could drop an entire bank track in there and have it look
right
like it's small. Because it would probably barely fit in there.
Yeah, you know, but it was an incredible facility, and it was really great for me when I would go ahead and see the Olympic on TV, not in wrestling or roller derby capacity, but like in Starsky and Hutch and things.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I'm sure it probably appeared in a lot of movies and TV shows, right?
Well, Rocky is probably the biggest thing that people remember.
Oh, I didn't know.
Rocky.
I didn't.
Yeah, they shot most of the final fight scene there at the Olympic Auditorium. Okay. There was a lot of TV that you're talking about, Starsky and Hutch. And this is an episode you can actually find for free on YouTube. I will tell the fans now. There's an episode from the second season of The Bionic Woman called right. In This Corner, Jamie Summers. And it was shot at the Olympic, and it's a great way to see what the Olympic looked like when it was set up for wrestling, because it was still being done there at that point. In fact, you see the famous rat cage or the shark the cage where it's in the background there.
Wow.
But it's about I think Norman Fell is an evil wrestling promoter of all women's wrestling shows.
Mr. Roper?
Mr. Roper, yeah, exactly. And you go in there and
would he laugh at his own jokes after he would say something?
You know? No, actually, what they were doing is they were using a women's wrestling promotion to pass spy information back and forth. But it was great because it was one of those things where she walked in off the street and they made her into, and she got in the ring and she did a couple moves. And they wound up making her into a wrestler that night. It sounds like a lot of wrestling schools they have around now.
And if you want a villain, it's always going to be a wrestling promoter. So.
It always has to be a wrestling promoter. Yeah. But there's a whole bunch. Well, of course, there's the famous, and I think this is still on Netflix too, Mad Bull, which starred Alex Karras.
Okay.
Which was shot directly there. And I believe some of Raging Bull was done there.
I think so. And the thing that comes to mind also is the episode of The Munsters where Herman Munster plays the wrestler. I forget his wrestling name, but that was all done at the Olympic.
At the Olympic, too.
Yeah, I mean, but the Rocky films are the big things there. And they, I guess they don't do any more shooting there. Now that it's a church.
It's a church. Don't. It's a Korean church. And I actually took the opportunity when I was in downtown LA and taking care of a traffic ticket not far from there.
Say it ain't so. Right.
It happened, but I took it upon myself to go ahead and go into the Olympic and speak to somebody who was part of the, I guess, the pastor of the church or whatnot.
Did they throw matzo powder in your face?
No, he didn't. Okay. But you know what? He was kind enough to go ahead and let me sort of have my time and walk around there, and he kind of trailed me and, you know, probably wondering what I was doing, but I
imagine they get that from time to time.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not many of us left that want to do that, but,
I remember going down the steps, you know, going down into where the locker rooms were, and what was really interesting is that this was about maybe 4 years ago, and we came to a door that was obviously put up later on, much later, maybe even recently. And we opened the door, and he said, oh, that's where we store a lot of our chairs and tables, but we never really go in there or anything. Well, we opened it up, and it was part of the old locker room. And the thing that was very interesting was that it smelled like old mildew, like mildewy water. And it had these chairs and these tables set up in there, but they were leaning against the wall. They had these pipes overhead, and it just smelled like like just.
You didn't happen to see a box of videotapes in there, right?
I did. I was looking around, you know, but it really had a funk.
I was going to ask you before you mentioned the smell that as you're walking around, are the sights and smells and memories coming back to you, and then you get the mildew smell? But
yeah, you know, it did. It happened that way, you know. But there was a lot of blocked off parts, a lot of blocked off, you know, partitions and such. The one thing I wish that they had kept, but. They got rid of this even back when the Olympic was functioning as a, you know, a wrestling venue still, was the tunnel that went down from the locker room into the main area. They had this sort of, what was it, an underground tunnel kind of, Dan?
That it's always been a great big... yeah, there's a lot of talk that there was a tunnel from under the ring, so if things got bad, you could go under the ring and go back to the dressing room. And I don't think I think I've talked to Jeff about it, and Jeff doesn't seem to remember it quite being that Hogan's Hero-ish or whatever, you know. you could see basically that there was at least a tunnel at some point. What was interesting also is the way they shot the show. You had a hard camera on that area where it was just the blue backdrop, and that's where the guys would talk, you know.
Right.
And then you had the shots from there at the Olympic, and you never saw like somebody left to go into the ring. You never saw that follow them. You would never follow them. You would see them walk off set, and then you would see them come down the aisle and get into the ring.
Right.
So it gave the impression this place was massive.
Right.
Anyway.
Right. And then I do remember the. Where the announcers would announce from, and it was that sort of bird's nest type of thing where, you know, to this day, I'm guessing that there was a, you know, they couldn't magically get up there, but I guess there must have been some sort of a ladder that
Andre would lift them up. Put them up there.
But I always found that just a fascinating thing.
Do you, we talked about the Battle Royal shows last time, but outside of Battle Royal shows, what other memories do you have of the Olympic from other memorable shows or whatever?
Well, gosh, I mean, every single time we went there, and we went there, you know, once to twice a week. I do remember going, my brother and I, we would just, first of all, just tour the whole place. Like, we'd almost never been there before, but we were there constantly, and go up and down the stairs and every corner of the, you know, the four corners of the Olympic, and, you know, check out all the food
until some
stands.
Guy came up to you and said, "Hey, you kids, get out of there!
Hey, you rotten kids!" You know, but you know, the Olympic was just so much fun, and you know, it was great watching the, you know, the matches and the cards that we had. The cards,
and actually, just to mention, I just handed Ken a couple of things. One of them is that's the famous the one picture is the famous. The marquee up front,
right.
And the other, there's a picture behind there is one from the 1920s, which shows you what it looked like back then. So you could see the ornateness of the way it was the way it was constructed, but also that picture is from 94 there. And I'm sorry you guys can't see this, but I'm just showing to Ken. You can see how big the floor is.
Yeah, that's my first look, never having the pleasure and opportunity to go there. I would not think it to be this big.
Yeah,
and looking at this shot you've got
now,
here.
Every time they did a renovation, they lost some chairs. They lost, but they started out like around 15,000, and I think by the time it was done, they probably lost about 5,000 out of that.
Yeah, but it was just so many great memories, and you know, it became just a second home. It became a second home to us, and you know, Dan mentioned this in the earlier podcast, is that. There was always an eclectic crowd that became very familiar between, you know, Josephine, the chicken lady that was at ringside, there was a big guy that used to go ahead and sell Coke, so we called him Bobo. I don't know why we called him Bobo, but we did. And there was another guy who would be screaming out programs to go ahead and sell programs, so we naturally called him Programs. And then my personal favorite...
Hey, there's Programs, eh?
There's programs, you know? And then my personal favorite was there was always this one... security, I guess he was a security guard who was always at the same spot every single week. And we started calling him the bellboy from I Love Lucy because he looked exactly like the bellboy from I Love Lucy.
Was it Johnny, I think, or something like that?
So yeah, we would just say, hey, bellboy from I Love Lucy, you know? He just kind of give us a nod and a smile, you know, because we would just call that every week. So it was just a fun group of people that you were there around.
That's the whole family aspect.
Yeah.
We talked about
and so it's a regular cast of characters, and we had made reference to Ebbets Field of baseball, mm-hmm. where they have you know, Hilda leading the symphonies. now you get these characters, and you had mentioned a blonde girl screaming in the previous one. So that's awesome. I love that.
Why don't we touch on this a little bit before, but why don't you? Why don't you tell us why you became a professional wrestling fan?
Well, it really started actually from my grandmother. And my grandmother lived with us, and she would watch wrestling on channel, you know, 13 or 5, whatever it was on at the time. And my oldest brother, Larry, would go and sit there with her and watch it. And that's where the seed started. And naturally, you know, me and my two brothers wanted to do whatever the big brother was doing. Mm-hmm. So we wound up going and sitting with Grandma and watching wrestling. My grandma, till the day she passed away, swears that we're somehow, some way related to Victor Rivera. Because the Puerto Rican, you know. But, you know, that's how the seeds of that started. And my grandmother was a wonderful, wonderful lady, but had this passion for watching wrestling every mm-hmm. week. And that got passed on to my oldest brother, Larry, and passed on to my brothers. Now, my two brothers don't watch it as much as I do. They've kind of, you know, they have their own things and families and everything. But we got together at Christmas, and they still put it on, just kind of watch for a little while and see how it's transgressed. And they have disappointment after a few minutes. Sure. And, you know, but it's something that we'll never forget. And the Olympic was just the stage, you know. It was our second home. It was a place we played around at, and we knew every step, we knew every crevice of that building, and it was our second home.
Do you remember the very first match you saw there?
I remember the very first show I went to was the Battle Royal show where Professor Toru Tanaka won. And it was because I just remember vividly my brother just throwing up all over the place.
Back to that again. There we go. Yeah.
And that's what really was the highlight.
He's going to love these two podcasts.
Yeah, that was the highlight of the night, was him just projecting vomit in the middle of the Olympics.
That's something, a little sidebar thing here is very interesting. Virtually everyone watched wrestling on TV first.
Right.
And I'll throw this out to both of you guys.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, even though it may not, it won't go into the California Classic area, I'd still like to know from you too, Ken. What do you remember after watching it on TV and going to your very first live show?
I just thought that this is the most exciting thing that I can watch in person. It was so just dramatic to me. It was so bigger than, you know, just really a big happening, and that was what drew it to me. And you know, I still get, you know, just this big kick from watching wrestling. I'm always going to have that. But initially it was just, you know, I was a huge baseball fan, a huge basketball fan, but this seemed it seemed bigger than that. It seemed, you know, like the really cool thing to watch. It was just a bigness about the wrestling and the big characters and the big promotion. And I don't know that I necessarily would have loved wrestling as much as I do to this day if it wasn't, you know, for people like Jeff Walton and people, you know, like Luis Magana and Miguel Alonso, who when they would announce, just make it the biggest thing there was, and it just drew me.
Yeah.
Did you get a chance to hear Dick Lane at all?
I do remember Dick Lane, but I was very, very young, but I do remember Dick Lane. I started getting more into it a little bit after, but I remember Dick Lane thinking the guy was great.
Amazing.
He was really great.
You know, to answer your question, Dan, for me, I didn't obviously grew up in the 80s watching the WWF and Vince Jr.'s massive expansion and destroying of your territories there. but I didn't go to any shows growing up, live shows, mm-hmm. always on TV until I moved to LA and started going to indie shows. And the thing that is the big difference, and this is, ties into the Olympic, is the thing that I love and still love, whether I'm in a show or watching a show, is the sound of that ring and the intensity and the energy that someone can bring mm-hmm. in that ring. Echoing when a spot happens and a bump yeah. happens. How did that sound in the Olympic, those moments?
Oh, those things were like, I mean, again, the size of that ring, mm-hmm. it always, you know, the thing to me, and this is just a general thing, mm-hmm. to bring it all the way around, there is something, I don't like to wax metaphysical here or whatever, but if you believe in something, it's if mm-hmm. I'm a big movie fan, so if yeah. I am on a set of a movie or find out that a movie was shot here or something,
right?
I have a tendency to get very I get very reverent in that situation sure. because it's like I feel like the phrase I use sounds very cliche, but magic happened here.
Yeah,
and that's kind of the same way I felt with wrestling. And when mm-hmm. I was able to walk into the Olympic the very first time, mm-hmm. I remember walking in, seeing the murals, seeing the characters wandering back and forth or whatever. And I think one of the things, this is kind of an interesting concept to throw out to you guys too. I remember one time in the last couple of years, I had a wrestler I was working with make some sort of remark about that they were kind of a rebellious guy and that you know, you Dan Farron are one of the cool kids and that's the reason why, you know, you don't like me or whatever. I have never been referred to as a cool kid when I was growing up. I was never one of the cool kids. My feeling is that, as with a lot of things, the kids that went to wrestling and watched wrestling weren't the cool kids. Yeah, most of right. us really weren't the cool. The cool kids were going out and they were dating and they were drinking and they were doing all those things, you know, where we stayed at home. You know, right. we didn't want to go outside. We watched wrestling. We read about wrestling. We went to wrestling. Yeah. You know, nobody who's a cool kid is in wrestling.
Right.
You know, we're all nerds to some extent.
Yeah. I think you had 84. It was
cool.
Cool. And yeah. then that faded away until the Attitude Era. I was a closeted wrestling fan. I couldn't let people know.
Yeah, the same way. I mean, it was even worse. I mean, I will tell the story, and it's always very funny, is my wife didn't find out I was a wrestling fan until after we got married.
Smart move.
I never let her know.
Smart man.
And then one day I said to her, I said, well, the WWF is at the sports arena. You want to go and see what it's like? And yeah. she said, well, sure, if you want to.
Do you like that?
And I said, and I said to her, I said, now if you get, you know, horrified by it or whatever, let yeah. me know and we'll leave or whatever. But actually she enjoyed mm-hmm. it to some extent, and she found it fascinating. Though she's still mad at me because I drug her over. Ivan Koloff was wrestling Mil Máscaras, and mm-hmm. Ivan Koloff got busted open. And this was back at a time in the sports arena there were no barricades. I mean, the fans would just line up on both sides, and they would right. walk past you. Right. And I drug her over there, and she felt like I was trying to push her into Ivan Koloff. I wasn't trying to push her into Ivan Koloff.
Nice going, Dan.
I know, exactly. But she was, you know. But, I mean... and that's, by the way, that's where wrestling can still surprise you, because I've been a fan. You always learn something from it. I've been a fan mm. since 1971.
Right.
And I was watching, as we talked about before on another show, the WWE 50th anniversary thing, and they interviewed Ivan Koloff, and I had never heard him speak in his real voice before. And it threw me, you know, because I wanted to see him. No, back in old days, I do this. You know, and he doesn't talk that way at all. And it threw me, you know.
Even now, it threw me.
But I imagine there were a lot of wives and girlfriends that were drugged to the Olympic Auditorium, right. You know, to have to watch this stuff. And I don't think, to me, if it's done even half well, there's no way you can't. I used to tease my wife because my wife watched soap operas, all my children mm-hmm. when it was on, mm-hmm. and I would, oh, this is stupid, this is dumb, you know that. But if I was in the room after a while, I'd say, now wait a minute, didn't she do this to that person, whatever? You can't help if right. it's laid out that way that right. you don't. There's a curiosity factor, you know.
Yeah.
And still to this day, I didn't talk about wrestling to any of my friends. I didn't have any wrestling friends growing up. I mean, friends who liked it. Then it was kind of cool when you said when wrestling became cool,
yeah.
that people would in turn talk to you or say, "Oh, I don't believe that," you know. But then I always found this was interesting. They would say, "Oh, the Olympic auditorium, yeah, I think I saw that once or twice, whatever." But then they would start naming names to me, which said to me that they knew more. I had an old roommate. He said, "Oh no, I never watched that stuff." But he always asked me questions about La Pantera Negra, which always threw me to no end that way. But there is something special, whether it be the Olympic auditorium or any place, of walking into an arena where wrestling is about to be held, whether it's an arena or a boys and girls club or a high school gym or wherever. To me, whenever I've worked on wrestling shows or even go to shows where people know me and I'm allowed to kind of wander around, I like to get there early. And you know from working on the MPW shows with me, I'll climb into the ring at some point before the guys start flipping around. And I like to just to walk around. Just to walk around the ring. I used to also, because I always like to check and make sure the boards were all in place. But but there's something nice about that, and you feel like you're at home. And as Ryan alluded to with the Olympic before, and with every other place, and I guarantee you, even if somebody here, grew up in the Mid-Atlantic areas or in World Class or whatever, they'll say the same thing. When you walked into your home arena, you were home.
And
you were safe, and you knew, to quote the line from Billy Joel, you know it was me they were coming to see to forget about life for a while.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why we went to it. You entered this whole different world. And when you walked in a place like the Olympic with the history that was there, and knowing what happened, was when I walked in the first time, I wanted to get down and genuflect. I mean, that's how I felt. And then when you walked around it, and then I know that when I was doing that aforementioned special that you are horrified by, but paid me more than wrestling ever did.
Right.
I had the opportunity of being alone or being in the Olympic, and unlike the other guys, who were younger guys working, whatever, I would wander around and I would go to the top and I would sit for a while, or I would go down to ringside and sit for a while. I would go back to the dressing room and sit just for a while, because I felt like I was getting an opportunity to do something that wouldn't be available later on.
Right.
I can truthfully say, on my bucket list that I refereed at the Olympic Auditorium.
Right.
And there's not a lot of people who can say that who aren't in jail. that's one of the things about it. Like I said, I know I got off on a little bit of a tangent there, but I mean, the Olympic is almost as much a state of mind as it is a mortar and brick building.
And it seems to be akin to what the Sportatorium had in Dallas versus Madison Square Garden or Cal Palace, which have their own history and I'm sure their own ghosts and feeling. But there was a more intimate nature to some of the Olympic and Sportatorium, where you watch wrestlers, you watch Kevin Von Erich walk through the Sportatorium before they tore it down, and you see his eyes go to a different place. I imagine there's something akin to that, right? I mean, the Olympic had that intimate, big but intimate kind of feel, and it was a weekly thing you guys went to.
And also, you talked to the guys that worked at the by the way, it took great restraint not to make a joke about the Von Erich's eyes going someplace weird, because there was a lot of other reasons why the Von Erich's eyes were that way, but that's just me being rude. But I think that there was, when you read about these places and you hear about these places, I have never, unfortunately, ever been inside Madison Square Garden. But I know that I might be overwhelmed, truthfully, to walk in there. Just not just with wrestling or boxing, but with all the history that happens there, because that's the feel you have. I was never so sad as I was when they tore down the San Bernardino Arena, because that was home for me for several years on Sunday nights, and still to this day, when I go back to San Bernardino, I like to drive past there, even though it's not there anymore. I like to have the feeling to it.
Yeah,
and that's a place also that I heard later on, and I was so distraught that when they were tearing it down, they pulled the bleachers and the chairs out. I would have driven by and grabbed a chair and taken it home with me.
Absolutely.
Just to hang on to, because it meant that much you know, to me. I collect those little baseball cards that had the little slivers of a seat from Detroit's, right, you know, from Tiger Stadium, because that to me this is part of the history that's disappearing, and I'm glad the Olympic is still there. Yeah, I wish they would do something different for it, but it, as we joked about before, it's still a place of worship. It was before, no, and now it officially is. And I hope that the day doesn't come that they wind up tearing it down. Then, mm. You know, I would hate to think that was just an empty parking lot, which they almost did several times. Mm-hmm. It's just, there's something. I remember my breath being taken away when I walked in there, and I've driven past the Cal Palace in Northern California. I want so badly to go in there. I hope that, you know, I don't know where it stands, if it's still going to be there or be torn down or whatever, but I hope not. I want to go to the Cal Palace at some point. It's like those guys that drive around and visit different baseball stadiums. Mm-hmm. Spend the entire summer going to a game here, going to a game there, and as much as I enjoy going to a game in a big stadium, Dodger Stadium is always great because it's still that rooting history. But growing up as a Baltimore Orioles fan, I'm sure that I would love the stadium they're in now, but it meant just as much to me to go to Memorial Stadium,
right,
the previous park,
right,
as it did.
Right, and one thing that I loved about the Olympic, too, is when you'd walk in the front and you would see the... you know, going up the steps and, you know, the space that lets you go up the steps, and then you would wind up going back down, mm-hmm, you know, towards the ring. It was just an awesome thing to look at when you walked into the Olympic, because you walk in, you can either go left or right, because you had the concession stand kind of, you know, off to the right a little bit there.
Yeah.
But you'd have these sort of hall, almost like a horseshoe type, yeah, of entrance to get into the actual seating.
That's always the cool thing too with the Olympic and with other places, is when you walk in into the lobby area, you see the entrance to the
actual
arena
seating, yeah,
and you can see a glimpse of the ring.
Right.
And little kids would get in there, and big kids too would want to run right up there because they want to see the ring. I got to see the ring.
Take me through, Ryan, for someone who did not get the chance to go, myself included, take me through just the simple routine of going. What would you and your brothers do? Where would you hit first?
Well, we would go ahead and go through the front of the building like everybody else, and our seats were always...
Oh, and by the way, no one used to frisk you in those days.
No.
Yeah,
so to get to our same seats that we had every single week, you'd go and turn right, and then go until the building ended and turn left, and then head towards the seating area. But my brother, who's 2 years older than me, and I always seem to find ourselves sort of ditching my other brother or both my brothers when all four of us were going, and just go up the stairs, because there were stairwells on all four corners, and just go up there and go to the second floor and walk around the second level. And, you know, when you went up the stairs, you remember, Dan, they'd have the pictures of, like... wrestlers and stuff,
yeah,
you know, uh-huh, there. So we would see all that and just be amazed at seeing that, and just kind of walk around the entire building and just get you know, a feel of the people that were around, mm-hmm, and, you know, just soak it all in.
Did you guys...
And there was no merch tables, by the way, in most cases.
No. Then how did wrestlers get over?
I know, exactly. They would have, you would have the programs that you would buy.
For 50 cents.
Yeah. And then occasionally they would do, I remember buying I think it was a Pork Chop Cash t-shirt, which was done so badly, silk screened. The picture could barely recognize it. And when you put your hand underneath the shirt, you could see your fingers. That's how thin it was. But they would occasionally sell pictures or that. But mm-hmm, that was about it. It wasn't the big stuff.
Did you guys have the same seats in general every time?
We had the same seats every single time. And my
choice or... season tickets, how did that work?
No, my brother Larry would just go ahead and purchase the tickets during the week, and it was always the same exact seats. The same, right, exact. So we knew exactly where to go, what row it was. And when you'd watch wrestling on TV, very often you'd see our little heads in the, you know, because we were directly across from the camera, and you'd see us sitting there. So
and you probably were surrounded by the same people every week.
Same
then, right?
People every week, and same spot. It was just so comfortable to be right there. And it was just... you know, you knew where all the concession stands were. You knew people by face. And not only by watching it on TV, but just by being there every week. And but every week, we would just kind of take our own mini tour and sort of walk around the second floor. We'd stop at the start of the top, work our way down, and just get a feel of the excitement. And just being there was just such a blast. And then we'd settle in before the, right before the matches started.
Was there access, good or bad, to the wrestlers before and after the shows? Was it where you knew where to go to wait to get in their cars, or where they were getting in their cars? Or
no. First of all, there was a big sort of dungeon-esque door that was the back of the building that the wrestlers would go in and out of. And the security was pretty tight by that door there. So it would be very hard to. I do remember having a few words back and forth with Larry Zbysko when the AWA came the one time. And, you know, that was, I thought it was kind of cool that he was kind of hanging out, you know, at the door there. But, no, as far as the we never went to the parking lot to go ahead and find them. I don't think the wrestlers necessarily even parked in the parking lot. I think that for fear of maybe the heels
especially.
Well, it was also a different time is what I was also going to get at next is, you know, you don't have fan access back then, signings and whatnot.
It was especially that way at the Olympic because it was the large building. And also, it was a time where the wrestlers paid a great deal of attention to kayfabe, and that is you were very rarely ever going to get a heel wrestler to do an autograph.
Right.
It just wasn't going to happen. Sometimes the face wrestlers were barely bothered to give you an autograph if you asked for it. But at the smaller arenas around, I know in San Bernardino for sure, but like at Strelick Stadium and Bakersfield and Ventura, where you were at the the fairgrounds, you had much better access. I know in San Bernardino, the guys parked in the same parking lot you did, and they would have to walk in the front door and go into the dressing room. And so you would see them on, you know, you had really good access actually to them in San Bernardino. The story I've told before is that Jerry Brown of the Hollywood Blondes, watching a match in full gear in the back, and a little cute little girl walked up to him and asking for his autograph. And he looked around, he looked down there and said, "All right, but don't tell anybody." And he signed it. And then I remember after I told that story, Pat Howard said, "I asked Jerry Brown for an autograph. He wouldn't give it to me." And I said, "Pat, you're an obnoxious teenager. What did you expect?" You know, he's not going to give it to you. But but the guys, but you had some access in the smaller places. But at the Olympic, they were very, very protective of the guys.
Did I'll make this make a baseball reference here. If you talk about the old Tiger Stadium or even Fenway Park now, hallowed grounds in baseball. But people would always be like, "Yeah, but it was kind of old and run down too the whole time." Did the Olympic have that feel, or was it up modern as it could be at the time?
No. It had the old school feel to it.
Okay. Yeah,
it
was, and that's not a bad thing. It adds to it.
I think it had an old school feel, but it wasn't run. It didn't feel run down.
Gotcha.
At least
No. Yeah. And I remember very clearly. I want to say this was around 80, maybe late 80, and I remember that they threw a new paint job on the Olympic, and they remember they called it the new Olympic Auditorium. And to me, it was ridiculous thinking, why are they calling it the new Olympic Auditorium when all they're doing is throwing a coat of paint over it and a couple of, you know, flashy sort of, you know, these kind of a weird design to it, to the paint, you know, flashy little style, whatever. But it was the old crevices, the old everything with fresh baby powder blue paint.
Yeah.
And I just thought, well, this isn't really, you know, doing much for me.
And I contend also that you know, it's an arguable point, that if they had moved in the middle of, let's say, in the middle of the 70s, had gone to the sports arena and stayed there, or had gone someplace else and stayed there, that the wrestling would have lost some of its personality, because the Olympic was tied into, as much as you possibly can be, into the wrestling, the local wrestling.
Yeah.
And it was like getting up and moving. It would just be weird to be someplace else. And I think the shows at the sports arena had a different feel to them because it wasn't the Olympic. Because the Olympic was part of the show, mm-hmm. being at the Olympic,
where the sports arena was just this oversized building for wrestling, mm-hmm. That had really zero personality to it. It really did, you know. There was just not that kick when you walk into the sports arena and the big concourse and go down the escalators.
Yeah, it's just a big multi-purpose sports building,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I get that.
It had no personality, mm-hmm. and you know, while it was fine going to the wrestling matches there, it was a disappointment compared to going to the Olympic. It just wasn't a comparison.
A little side trip, which still ties in, because I know we talked about this once before. The other great building that was besides, you know, there was a building at the pier in Santa Monica, and mm-hmm. and there was another building in Long Beach at one point, right there on the ocean. And those are long gone, but there was another very memorable arena in town. Hollywood Legion Stadium,
right?
That was mm-hmm. that was where boxing and wrestling was at. That's where a lot of the wrestling shows you see on YouTube mm-hmm. were held at Hollywood Legion Stadium. Which is no longer there. But you told me about a tour you took through where it was. Right. Can you talk about that?
Well, Hollywood Legion Stadium, again, almost as iconic as the Olympic. Was sort of transformed. It went from hosting wrestling and boxing to ultimately it became a bowling alley. Hmm. And for people who've watched Chick Hearn on Bowling for Dollars back in the day, that's where it was filmed.
Okay.
At the Hollywood Legion Stadium.
Where's the location?
That's located on El Centro and just south of Hollywood Boulevard.
Okay.
So it was right there, and then ultimately it got out of being a bowling alley, and it now still is a 24-hour fitness. And so I remember
a lot of history there.
I remember, yeah. Well, I did go ahead and one night, because my work was the next block over, and I went over there, and of course the inside's completely redone and everything, but the outside still has the big giant doors where crowds would come in and out. So mm-hmm. those doors were still there, except that they never ever opened them. They're like, they're there, but they're permanently locked. So, but that's about the only thing left of Hollywood Legion Stadium. And, you know, very, very interesting to go by there now and see mm-hmm. them.
Yeah, it really is, and that was another place that we'll talk about those on future shows. Yeah. Hollywood Legion Stadium was so tied in to the public knowledge from boxing and TV that they actually made a movie. There's a movie called, I think it's called either Legion Stadium Mystery or Hollywood Legion Stadium Mystery. It is actually on YouTube in full if you want to see it. It's it was a mystery set at the boxing scene at Hollywood Legion Stadium. So, you know, for them to put a building in the title, you know, yeah. you know, it has to be well known or something to be recognizable that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even going to a place like the Forum, just not the same magic. It's just not there. Maybe for Lakers, yeah. For wrestling, it held a lot of wrestling in its time. Mm-hmm. Just never has magic.
So we'll never have that time where the buildings have so much personality. Look, I love the Staples Center. That's a luxurious, wonderful place to see many events. But it's so big and giant. We don't have those spots to go sit every week and watch the same thing over and over that feel part of the show. Very rarely will
yeah,
you find that anywhere.
It's just not the same feel. Yeah. You know, wonderful facility. Love going there, watch me a Clipper game anytime, but
yeah.
just it's not something that I'll go ahead and keep in my memory banks because it just didn't have the meaning that a place like the Olympic had. And like Dan mentioned earlier, I'm glad it's still there. I actually asked the pastor of the church there, would he ever consider having a wrestling show there and have the proceeds go to the church? And in his broken English, he said, no, we have this building blessed. We will never have violence here again.
And you're like, well, what about work? Never mind.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah. Yeah. One of the things that's one of the things about it is it is part of the atmosphere.
Yeah. You have to have that. So. Now, both of you remember the phone number, right?
Yep. Richmond 95171. That's Richmond 95171.
I'm holding in my hand Richmond 95171, a wrestling story by Jeff Walton with Scott Walton, our good friend. A lot of great stories in this book about the Olympic and all the history there, too. So we're going to hope to have Jeff, and I know he's been on one of your previous podcasts, but hope to have Jeff and Scott come out for this too one time.
By the way, that book, honestly, is a great, great read. And if anybody who's never even been in California who just wants to know about great wrestling.
Well, it goes beyond that, too.
It does. It is truly.
Memphis is Tux Newman and all that good stuff.
Yes,
yeah.
It is truly a book that any wrestling fan needs to have.
Yeah. Absolutely. As we close here, what are some any more memories, gentlemen, on the Olympic?
Ryan, why don't you see if you have anything? Because see, you would remember it as through the eyes of a child, which I think is much more interesting as opposed to a cynical adult. Why don't you?
Well, there's so many memories, and this may sound kind of weird, but the Olympic was such a homey place to me that. Even the weird memories, I mean, the bathrooms there. The bathrooms are. It was the first bathroom I ever went to where it was a long trough.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, you know? The Dodger Stadium P trough.
Or
the Forum, too.
Yeah. And, you know, it was rather disturbing when the trough would clog up and you'd wind up having to march through urine. But, you know, it's all those.
There's a memory.
It's all those types of things. And, but, you know, it all went hand in hand. The great characters, the great wrestlers. It was just all tied in. I mean, I'll never ever forget Josephine. I'll never forget Jimmy Lennon and Red Shoes. Mm-hmm. It's just memories that attach to me and last me and my brothers a lifetime. Yeah. And the wrestlers, I mean, Bengali, El Negro, you know, Mondo Lopez Superstar. I mean, you know, they're not big names, but just the memories.
Big to you forever.
Just stay with me forever.
Do you remember, are you aware of the last time you went there during that era? Not counting your trip to the Korean church where you interrupted the pastor's service.
No. Just the last shows were the WWF shows.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cool, but different.
Yeah.
But it was cool. I'm glad I was able to go to those.
Mm-hmm. Dan, do you want to give us some non-cynical memory?
I think that, in a way, the big wrestlers, the wrestlers who were mostly identified with the Olympic, Mil Máscaras, John Tolles, Freddie Blassie, the Guerreros, Piper, so many of those guys, they became kind of a family member to some extent.
Right.
And I know that it's always funny because when I did meet Roddy Piper, which we talked about in one of the other shows, I mentioned the Olympic, and he was just amazed that anybody still remembers that because it's so long ago.
He's amazed that people remember Roddy Piper.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
He's generally sincerely happy and touched.
And that's been one of the things. I mean, again, that's one of the things that's really nice when I've wound up through the Facebook page meeting some of these guys.
Yeah,
the fact that someone's taking the time to remember something that was so long ago. When you think about it, 1982 was the last time there was territorial wrestling in Southern California. So there's not a lot of those pioneers still left.
Yeah.
So when I wind up through the pages talking to Mr. Mexico number 2 or Chavo Guerrero, who's been very complimentary toward the page, even Leilani Kai and Susan Green, wrestlers like that, it's been very, very nice to kind of have a venue where they can relive some of these memories. Because, I mean, it's so memorable to us. Think what it's like to them. I mean, and again, you know, that's one of the things I would ask whenever I meet someone who worked there, what was it like to say, I worked at the Olympic Auditorium, mm-hmm. you know, because it would have to be a high point. I know it is, even for the little crappy time I spent there. It's still a high point on my list to say that I worked in the ring there.
Mm-hmm. And just to piggyback a little bit on Roddy Piper, I did get a chance to meet him, and I mentioned the Olympic Auditorium days, and he very eloquently said, "Well, you know something, then you and I grew up together."
Yeah.
Over there.
Yeah, yeah.
And nice. That's what it was. It was his house and yeah. my house, and we shared it.
Well, I remember at the first MPW show of the reboot in 2010 when Piper was in our ring and Scott Walton was in the crowd, mm-hmm. and Piper's doing his thing, cutting a promo, and Scott somehow mentions who he is and who his father was, Jeff, and Piper stopped cold
yeah.
and had a really warm moment with Scott talking about Jeff and
right.
the history of the Olympic.
Yeah.
That's clearly what it means to him and then to all the people who were there and lived and worked there all yeah. those years.
Yeah, we shared that home.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, this has been a great first look at the Olympic. This is not going to be the last time we're going to talk about
nope.
it. And awesome. We're going to have this, like I said, this is a continuing and endless series that we're going to have here. California Classic Wrestling Podcast takes a look at the Olympic. So I'm so happy that, Ryan, you were able to come into the lounge and share your memories.
Thank you so much. It's
and
been
I'm
so great.
Glad you survived those gunshots.
Yeah, I am too. You know, there's an interesting memory.
And maybe you and your brother can throw up during Battle Royal for old Penn State.
Right? Got to talk him into that.
And Dan, thanks again for bringing you and your history books, man. You are a walking, talking history book of wrestling. And Dan, talk a little bit about the California Classic Wrestling Facebook group.
Yeah, just California Classic Wrestling on Facebook. You can either find it through doing a search or through my name. If you want to learn about no one is going to basically say, "Oh, well, you're a newbie, shut up, don't say anything." Mm-hmm. Or while a lot of us do feel like there's wrestling today that's missing something that we like the past wrestling a little bit more, no one's going to be very critical to you. It's a very, very open page, very friendly page. Everyone is more than happy to share information. And if you have questions, it's not something that you would need to be scared of. No one's going to run you down or make fun of you because of that. I've answered the same question several times over and over again, and I don't mind because people come in at different times and they see things and they don't see things. So definitely, if you get a chance to join us, I think you'll learn a lot about the rich history of Southern California and Northern California wrestling, even if you aren't from California and just want to learn more about wrestling history in general. I mean, all the big names pass through here one time or another. Mm-hmm. So please join us and give it a try, and I think that you'll find that it's a nice little community.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And find the Wrestling Viewpoint Network on Facebook as well. Like us there. Follow us on Twitter at WrestlingVN. You can follow me on Twitter at Ken Napzok. You can follow Dan Farron at Real Dan Farron. And Ryan Doyle, you are again on Twitter.
I am on Twitter. You can follow me at Ryan A. Doyle.
Ryan A. Doyle. Don't forget to find the California Classic Wrestling Podcast and all of the Wrestling Viewpoint Network broadcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, or Podomatic. If you're on iTunes, do us a favor. Subscribe so you won't miss a show. And also leave a comment, rate, and review this podcast so we can move higher into the echelon of wrestling podcasts everywhere. And that has been a great episode, a first look at the Olympic and all its history and its memories. We're going to have a lot more and a lot more great things on the California Classic Wrestling Podcast and the Wrestling Viewpoint Network. So for Ryan, Dan, I'm Ken Napzok. We will see you next time.